Good morning and welcome to the Thursday, May 6th agenda for the National Research Subcommittee for Shortwave Meeting. Today, we are continuing with the overview of the Department of Fish and Wildlife budget, House Bill 5023. We'll start today with a response to some questions that were asked yesterday about the program, and then we'll go ahead into the division overview for the Wildlife Division. We'll turn it over to the Director, Greer.
I want to know about the mafia.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Jim Greer, Director of Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. I'd like to point out that Ken Rocco, your staff, has a number of handouts that would respond to a number of the questions that came to us yesterday.
Mr. Chair, if members would like to stop by before they leave, I'll give them a packet of this information that the department brought forward. There's a pamphlet on the Landowner Assistance Program, a Wildlife Management Unit Map, the administrative rules regarding endangered species, and then two publications on game statistics, big game and game birds.
Thank you, sir. Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe it would be good if we did start off with the mafia question. My understanding that probably where that came from was a discussion with maybe some of the folks that you've had dealings with in the field, where I think there's a belief by some folks that the Portland office tends to stifle or not listen to our field recommendations. I want to assure you that that's not the case. There's always going to be interchange between our field and our Portland staff, and it has to be that way. And we rely on those field folks for that information. So in any kind of organization like ours, I think you're going to see differences from time to time in terms of what the final recommendation looks like compared to what their original input is. But without that input, the Portland staff would be lost. So I want to assure you that we're listening to those folks. We're also taking their recommendations. And I would say that, particularly on the wildlife side, which is where we've been discussing these kinds of issues lately, we'll probably see 90 to 95% of those recommendations from the field staff go forward to the commission. So I just wanted to assure you, if that's the perspective that you had on where that term may have come from, I want to assure you that that's how we're handling those kinds of relationships. We'll continue to improve that communication.
Questions from the committee?
Clean as no cement boots. What's the deal here?
Actually, there may be some semantics. In point of fact, the concept that there might be two cultures developing within the agency is exactly what that term refers to. And field staff often is very frustrated and expresses that frustration in a variety of ways. But there always is a dichotomy between the home office and the field offices, no matter what agency or organization, private or public, they happen to be in. You don't even have to look further than cooks and waiters. There are definitely dichotomies between management organizations and the field staff. But I think the thing that really is important here is that we all recognize that the field staff is the staff that interfaces with the landowner. And their recommendations may result from years of experience in negotiating with landowners. And they make those recommendations based on their knowledge, experience of the local conditions. And when they put those forward, if those things aren't moving forward largely unmodified, then essentially that disconnect and overturns the understanding that may exist in the field. Of course, that will also explain the budget note that relocates the headquarters to Hermiston. You got a good lot over there, and there's some new development going on in Hermiston, I understand.
Not in Burns?
Well, put an office in Burns. Any other questions about that? Sure, if you haven't heard the term before, I'm glad you heard it here and took the time to check it. It is exactly about the potential dichotomy between field staff and Portland staff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate that. Essentially, our division director, Rich Berry, has completed his overview, and I think maybe if we just started with some of those key questions that you listed at the end of yesterday's session, we can start with there, and I'll turn it over to Rich Berry.
Thank you, Chair Perry Olden, members of the committee. For the first time, I'm Rich Berry, I'm the Wildlife Division Director for the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. The first issue, and I believe that Mr. Rockwell has a handout, is what we have developed, and just to give you an overview, is a backgrounder on the Landowner Preference Program, And Senator Perry already talked about yesterday, just kind of the trying to meet the needs of hunters and private landowners and how the program works together. If you're leisure, you may want to just look through this and kind of give you a history of how we got to where we are today. And certainly the program has evolved over time. Some major changes in the program actually happened with a task force that was headed by, at the time, Representative Carl Hostica. Is from the legislature, and that made some early changes in the early 1990s. And so it is an ongoing program, and one that I would suspect will continue to evolve as we try to meet the needs of all. But again, it is one that from the hunting public side and the landowner side, there may be differences of how we should proceed. And as I stated yesterday, with the legislation, due to sunset in the year 2001, we are reviewing the program and will involve landowners and the hunting community if we do that. So with that, I believe that was really the only question or just a follow-up that we did have with background, which we thought might provide you some information and just background on the program.
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate having the information here, but I do think it's important to, from my perspective and from what I hear in my constituents, to share with you that there is a great deal of dissatisfaction with the landowner preference program for those people, for those sportsmen and hunters who are running into an ever-seeming shrinking ability to be able to participate in hunting, things that some of these people have done for the last 40, 50 years, and suddenly we're encountering these sort of programs coming along, and there's a great deal of dissatisfaction, and I think probably, with all due respect, there's likely to be some declining tag and license sales because of those dissatisfactions.
Senator
Fine. Rich, what does unlimited hunting mean? Can you show me the reference, Senator Connelly?
I don't have it handy. It's in my office, and I apologize for not bringing it down. Maybe we'll get it down. But I had a phone call from a constituent who hunts Eastern Oregon. And the indication is that a person can take unlimited amount of animals in that area.
Senator Tarnal, there's no such regulation for that. What I might say, another term potentially for unlimited could be a general season versus a controlled hunt season. In other words, a controlled hunt is where you have to draw a tag in order to hunt.
So then if you need to stop by my office sometime later on today, for instance, we can take a look at that.
Senator Tarnal, I actually have those kinds of questions to answer. And definitions are important. Unlimited sounds great. Maybe a better term out there. But, when you get the answer to the constituent question, could I get a copy of that? I get that letter a lot, too. Any other questions?
Thank you. The second question concerned the guides and outfitters application process. I believe that Senator Metzger had asked that question. I put together a little handout just to kind of lead you through that process. And I believe the question that Senator Nestor asked was, do the guides, could a non-resident, for example, get a tag earlier than the general public food control hunt process? The answer shortly is yes, and I'd like to go back just through the process. The legislature has established by statute that in our control hunt process for deer and elk, that not more than 5% of any tags available may go to non-residents. Now, that only means that if there are enough non-residents to apply to reach that 5%, that 5% of them would actually go to non-residents. Also, by statute, though, they have also said that for the guides and packers, these are the individuals that are trying to bring people to Oregon, and they do this through national advertising and through national meetings and so on that they may be attending, also says that up to one half of the tags that were non-resident the previous year in any hunt unit can be made available to guides and packers. Now, as the scenario unfolds, however, what we do is we then will look at last year's hunt, see how many non-residents there were in that hunt unit, and then we will provide a list to the guides and packers in early December that these are the hunts where we had non-residents, and here's what half of that is. And guides and packers may apply for those. what we see from that then, though, is they have the opportunity to apply. Many of them may apply for the exact hunt. And the one just down at the bottom, it says tag fee is 2 times the normal resident fee. It ends up that they may apply for some, but what they actually end up selling, for example, they could have applied for 1,891 tags for the non-resident. They ended up selling only 189 through their process, through their advertising business. Also, what they end up paying is 2 times the normal non-resident fee. So if a guide and packer uses that tag, they must pay 2 times the fee. What they do then is, in order for them to be assured, they have to apply to us by December 1. By December 31, we tell them whether they were successful in their draw. They then go out, try to sell their hunt packages through sports meetings, nationwide advertising, whatever. And they must then, by April 1, notify us how many of the tags they want to purchase and, in fact, give us the name of the hunter and, in fact, pay the double fee. Any tags that they do not end up, then just go back into the normal draw. So anybody could then end up drawing that tag, whether it be a resident or a non-resident, through the process. So, yes, they could, through a guide and packer, a non-resident would have been assured a tag earlier than what our normal public will through the June drawing.
I have a question on this issue. Is this information being published in the hunting and fishing publications that the agency puts out? Are you putting this information out to people in a readily accessible form?
Senator Perry, there's about 194 guides and packers. All of them are sent a whole packet on it. In our regulation booklet, we do have the information for guides and packers and available.
Let me rephrase my question. This information that you've given shows that about 189 tags are actually sold. And we don't know how many of those were filled. I imagine you know how many tags got filled. I'd even be interested to know what the average value of the hunt was to the guide and packer. It's probably between $5,000 and $10,000 per tag sold. But I'd like to know that. That's the multiplier factor, is one of those elusive details that we always are searching for. What's the actual value to the recreation industry in Oregon? But the fact is that when I talk to hunters, they think that there is a they know that there is a certain percentage of the tags that are allocated to non-resident hunters, and they know that half of those tags are available to licensed guides and packers. And so they do the math and figure there's 1,891 tags that are not available to local hunters that are somehow withdrawn from the general public and available only to guides and packers, and that all of them get sold and all of them get filled, and they're all trophy animals. And so you want to talk about some anger and some bitterness out there. People that have been hunting elk for years and big game animals think that this is a terrible idea. At least that's some of the feedback I've got. We've tried to explain that it puts folks on the same kind of competitive basis as Idaho, Washington, and Montana guys and packers who can get guaranteed tags. And Oregon was the only state on the list that we could find that couldn't guarantee its guides and packers an opportunity to have the market because of our draw system. But 189 is a long way from 1,891. I don't think the general public knows the numbers. And I'm asking you about these numbers, not the process for application.
These numbers are not in our regulations. If you believe from a public perception standpoint and just informational standpoint, we could look at putting a blurb within our book about how the process is working, trying to mitigate some of the concerns.
I think it'd be beneficial to report back to the hunting population. We made a major change in the law in 1997, and people want to see how it's playing out on the ground. And if there's I don't think guides and packers probably did a great deal more business this year than they did last year. And we ought to have some comparison before and after the value of the hunt and actual numbers. And I think that's going to change people's perception about what we actually did with this law. I get a lot of calls and a lot of letters on this bill. So I think it'd be helpful. This is a much different picture than I had in mind.
Okay, well, we can do that.
Other questions?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. on this topic, and I appreciate you bringing this and did a little look into the 97 law that was passed on it. I think the concern that I would have is with this allocation system, it's just basically a fairness question. And that is, I understand the guys and outfitters' needs, because they're out in February, you know, going to the shows, and they need to market that. And personally, I appreciate that and understand how that needs to be done. My concern is that, you know, I have people out there working on putting their hunting parties together, and it's June and July, and they're just now finding out that Bill didn't get one, and he had set up, you know, Merrill Lubin got his vacation set up, and now he can't go, and they've had a difficulty in planning their own residents putting together their vacation plans and their hunts, and they don't find out for 6 months. Whereas if they're out of state and they just, you know, bought, you know, through a hunter, through a guide and outfitter, they could know that they had a tag and when they're going to go. And so I guess, I don't know if there's a way this can be tweaked so that residents basically move up the system in terms of the time so that they too can have that same opportunity to plan their hunts and find out when their vacations are and their buddies and they can go out. And it's not so much on depriving the guys and outfitters that early notice, but rather to give residents more early notice so that they can have that same opportunity to know whether they're going to have hunts or not. And I guess that's the fairness issue that I'm concerned about is people not knowing whether them or their buddies can go out and until July in some cases because of the draw system, whereas someone else you know, has been able to plan that for 5 or 6 months.
Isn't there a bill floating around here that has a study going out for landowner preferences and draw tags and some other things?
Apparently, there has been a bill introduced that would look at that. I'm not sure where it is in the committee process. It has not had a hearing to my recollection so far. Senator Metzger, I mean, I appreciate your concern in the process. One of the things as we look at our control hunt process, we can certainly address that. The hard part that we have is that when we set our tag numbers, the information is just now being completed, being gained by our district biologists. In other words, how did the animals survive the winter? What was the survival rate for calves, fawns, and deer themselves? Was it a hard winter, et cetera, which then sets the number of tags, which goes into our drawing. I think when the legislation was established, that's why it actually went back and said, you've got to look at the previous year, and that sets the goalpost for kind of how many tags may or may not be available. It is a hard process, but again, as we look at our control hunt system, I share your concern of how we can have our people know earlier in the system that they were, in fact, successful with a tag. What the commission does do, though, is they will be setting this June and October the final dates for the season that will occur in the year 2000. So for vacation planning and so on, what you don't know, though, is whether I will be successful, for example, to obtain a tag for the time period I would like to go for. Setting the dates we have found, some hunters and others, is that at least helps me plan somewhat my vacation for the following year. Because many of the hunters tend to go back to the same areas or the same hunts that they had in previous years.
I don't know the answer is, but that's my concern on it. Thank you.
I think that's the issue that I hear more about than almost any other in ODF&W and Children's Services Division. And my representative.
Mr. Chair, to echo a little bit, we're Senator Messer and these concerns. That one of the concerns I have with this is, as I said just a minute ago, that we're potentially, I think, losing people in the process because they are unable to plan. They're unable, they don't get their tags, and I think this is a real problem for the agency. I think it's a problem the agency has to look at, and that we need to work on is this public relations thing. I'm not suggesting that they don't have a complicated and complex issue to deal with, but I think they need to be very sensitive to the fact that some of the things they're doing is really alienating them from the public out there. And I, too, get, in my district, a disproportionate amount of inquiries about the policies out of the agency in relationship, especially the big game hunts.
Am I able to get on a website and apply for a hunt?
Could I give my visa card and fill out my license application and get a license mailed back to me, you know, by contacting ODF and Vigor?
Sure, listeners, can you carry your licenses? Jack, we'll get to that point later on. That's a controlled hunt, Jeff, but for the licenses you can, hunting and fishing.
They're going to come pretty quickly.
We hope so, yes. After we get through this first year, I've actually taken on a point-of-sale process ourselves in terms of having that draw work for the department rather than a contractor. We'll see how far we can expand that.
I do that. So the fire department that I direct, most of our teams now register. They just get on the website, they fill out the application, you know, they're registered, and right there. And I would think that that's not too difficult, you know, to do. I mean, we have administrative things to follow up, you know, from that point, but I don't think we're talking rocket science here. I think there are some 14-year-olds that could test the, you know, the basic product.
Representative Jensen, and then I have a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Before the department goes too far with my good friend's suggestion, I would like to remind you that many of the people in my area who are hunters, grizzly old mountain man type, have not yet become aware of what a computer is, let alone knowing how to go to or get to a website to be able to follow your process through. That will cause more, I think, constituent problems for me if that's the system we go to. Young people, the 14-year-olds, are going to be able to do it. I understand that. The 65-year-olds that have never been there may have difficulty.
Representative Jensen, some of the folks in your district can't hang up with a rock.
Yeah, that's true.
If I could follow up, because in no way was I suggesting that is the way, but I think it would be helpful to be a way.
My question has to do with the draw system or the tag allocation system in neighboring states. Are we drawing, do we have draw system in Idaho, you know?
Mr. Chair, Senator Perillo, yes. In fact, Idaho was looking at adopting our system. Many more states are now going to a point-of-sale process and electronic transfer of those kind of documents. We were probably one of the first in the nation here about 3 or 4 years ago. So that is appearing to be the way to go.
And Washington State?
I believe they also have controlled hunt.
I know that elk hunters in the east side of the state of Oregon have the choice of driving 40 minutes more and hunting in Idaho. And they often make the choice to do that. And it's because of the relatively easier availability of
I'm going to just respond to that to Senator Ferrioli. They have gone to they're starting to explore some of the same kind of hunt options that we have been exploring for the last several years. They have had more availability, particularly of non-resident tags. Our state has a 5% cap by statute of any controlled hunt. So we only allow up to 5% participation in any controlled hunt, where many states like Idaho, Colorado, Montana, they really rely on the non-resident hunter as a part of their overall revenue generation and probably a greater portion percentage-wise of their overall hunting public. I think we're probably going to see some changes in Idaho because they're starting to experience some of the same things we have experienced maybe 10, 15 years ago in terms of bull management, buck management. They have these large blocks of wilderness areas. So they've been able to maintain earlier seasons, seasons when elk are in the rut in September. So those have been very attractive. But they're now starting to see some of the same things we saw in past years, and the bull ratio is going down. And my understanding of some of their programs, they may not have quite the number of tags available they've had in the past, particularly the non-residents. So.
Thank you.
Senator Farrelly, the last two questions that you asked, one centered on the hunt season opening date and on a Wednesday opening date and how that works. That has been, just as a little history, where that occurs primarily right now is in eastern Oregon with Rocky Mountain elk season. And back in the 1970s, just to give you an overview, 1970s we had one general season, 16 days long. essentially what happened. Everybody shows up opening day, just trying to deal with that situation. From the hunters also looking for hunting experiences, except the early 1980s, we went to a split season. In that discussion of split season being, well, if they are equal lengths in time, does that mean everybody will come first season? Essentially, you did nothing. Kind of spread out hunter participation, hunter opportunity. Eventually, what they ended up with in the mid-80s was that split season with a starting on Wednesday. So we actually had this Wednesday starting date since the early 1980s. That was carried forward into the adoption of the elk management plan that the commission did through lots of public testimony and so on. And yes, it does give, someone talked to me a little bit about this as well, it depends for those on the east side, it certainly, I can leave my home and I can be out hunting within hours. We do have a lot of west side people that hunt on the east side, and it was, no matter whether it opens on a Wednesday or whether it opens on a Saturday, they're probably going to take some time off during the week in order to do their travel, get their out camp set up, and so on. The split season with a Wednesday with a break in between does allow a rest time for the animals so they're not constantly hunted. As far as those split seasons, we see a variety. We see some seasons very heavily subscribed to for the early seasons in some units and other units. We see low participation in the first season and higher in the second. We can also adjust that participation by what type of animal you are able to take, whether it might be a spike bull or a full branch antler bull or whether it be a cow season. So there's a number of variables that can lead into those types of seasons in the set date. But the Wednesday one was, I guess I would say, certainly from the hunting community, but understanding that there can be hardships for some people no matter what day you pick, only because of a work schedule trying to do that. Senator Corker asked the question kind of about how successful were hunters, were they successful like the first part of the season. That also varies. We were looking at a number of the hunt units yesterday, and generally probably answers yes. They may be a little bit more successful only because the hunting seasons may or may not have been open. But we also, within the hunting seasons, if the commission wrestles with deer, elk, bear, cougar, turkey, waterfowl, etc., and also look at weapon type, whether it be rifle, whether it be archery, whether it be muzzleloader, trying to have all the people want, call it a hunt that's designed for their type of hunting opportunity, we are going to have some of these things. We're trying to mix and match and still provide the hunting opportunity. It's very difficult. But on the first hunt of the season, again, by depending on what you're capable of taking during that first hunt within that unit, that can be maybe not as successful as people who then go for the second hunt. The preference point system is designed to help people within that in a way. If they're really a high-quality hunt, branch bull antlers, tag numbers are limited, but with a preference point system, you're going to get there eventually, and not everybody will be there the same year. So it all kind of works together.
Sure. Yeah, I share your concern about starting a hunt in the middle of the week because it does adversely affect, you know, blue-collar working folks that do the Monday to Friday thing. But it doesn't get us the real perversity of having a hunting season when these animals are rutting. Thank you.
The last question, Chair Perioli, I believe you asked about was on our agricultural hunt success. That one, I did talk with our district, our region, particularly Northeast and High Desert region yesterday. With the number of opportunities or tools that our district people now have to work with the landowners, we have our landowner preference program. We are able to exchange, if they don't use the tags, they can exchange those at 2-for-1 for antlerless animals. We also have our controlled hunt process where we use through the normal controlled hunt process. We have some hunts that are private land only. We have some that are special cow hunts. Again, the success to deal with a lot of the agricultural ones, we have to have the cooperation of the agricultural landowner. And we think we're getting that in more of the tools that we have available for them. We also sell special damage hunts. You as a landowner, agreement to have a hunt there. We also have emergency hunts. The success of the program is talking with our regional supervisors group for those two regions felt that it was working successfully. One of the measures that they're using for success is the number of complaints they're getting. The other is from the landowners themselves who have said, my damage is reduced, I don't need these hunts, I don't want the hunts anymore, or let's go ahead and reduce the tag numbers. And our people work with those landowners to cooperatively agree on the numbers that may be available and the LLP tags that are exchanged, that type of thing. So I think what I got from them was they think the tools are there. We now have a wide variety of tools through the legislative process, so things are provided for them, and it is working. We are addressing those damage situations. Again, it must depend on a cooperative landowner within the situation. And sometimes we may have a landowner who's in the cooperative, but an adjacent one may not want to participate. That does make the resolution a little harder.
So I was just thinking about the alfalfa farmers on the east side. But, I have seen, just driving from Fisher Gorge to Grande, 1,500 to 2,000 in that half-hour drive. And those are, that's just a, I won't tell you how fast I'm going, but it's a snapshot. It's not an observation. It's just, there's a lot of deer over there. And they congregate in the river valleys and the lowlands and on the ag lands. You know, the uplands are primarily federally managed lands. And the lowlands are somebody paying taxes and trying to eat the living out on the agricultural community. And the animal damage at $158 million a year is understating the real cost to the landowners by any time over. Those are just what's reported. It just really concerns me that there be a better relationship or the best possible relationship between the landowner and the agency on the animal damage control issues, because that sets the tone for all the other relationships that we have with them.
I share your concerns senatorially, and I think with the landowners, not sure specifically the ones, but I know our people do work with them, and again, different landowners have different tolerance levels that they're willing to experience and for different reasons. But my sense I get is I think we are dealing with these effectively, and it's not an easy resolution because of multiple land ownerships and where the animals may be at some given point in time.
Just a kind of general question. Do you have any assessment of the impact of the potlatch farms have been in eastern Oregon on wildlife? I mean, it's incredible habitat for them, and I wonder if you have had any assessment to count numbers, anything of that.
Representative Jensen, I don't have specifically. I could check with our people in Northeast Oregon and try to get their perspective. Certainly the tilled lands and so on that may have been for upland game birds or so on, maybe a different one, but we can get you some information on what we've seen from the impacts for that.
And one other question, if I could, Mr. Chair. Mm-hmm. Without wishing to be paranoid, is there some reason that page 231 in this book is a ghost page? We go from 200 to 232. Is that a typographical computer error, or is there a ghost page there that somebody didn't want us to see?
Actually, Representative Jensen, that is the page detailing the management plans for the northeast portion of the state of Oregon.
Yeah, that's what I was looking for.
With budget.
With budget.
Exactly.
Okay. Everything was there.
What page is that?
Very early. That concludes my answer to the questions that you posed yesterday.
Okay, my question on this is most of these are computer driven on the, I assume, on the numbering system.
We'll defer the answer to that question until the appropriate technology can be brought to bear. Expect it to be answered before. So we move to the next section of our presentation. We get the fish and wildlife, our fish department. Fish department. Thank you. Before we launch into the fish division, there are a couple of announcements. College, you've been sent a letter inviting you to public testimony for this committee plan for Tuesday, May 11th from 1 to 4 p.m. That probably will conflict with everybody schedule. Notwithstanding that, remember a subcommittee of one can take public testimony if necessary, but we offer the public an opportunity to address the issues that we're dealing with here.
Yeah, Tuesday, May 11th, 1 to 4 p.m. in room 50. A letter's been sent to your staff by our administrator, and I invite you to review your schedule if you can't be there for the entire three-hour block. As much time as you could devote to this, I think it'd be worthwhile. Give us an opportunity to hear from the public on the issue.
This will be on ODF&W?
Yes, on ODF&W budget. And issues related there, too. We also have a floor session this morning at 10, but the Republican Senate will be caucusing at quarter of. So we'll excuse those members at quarter of.
What are you going to be talking about, Mr. Chair?
I don't know.
I know.
What is it?
You
got $5 on you?
You sell out your pockets for $5, Senator. Things are tough on the cost of
So we proceed.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to ask you, Dr. Douglas Harkey, for our Fish Division Director, and he'll begin the overview of the Fish Division program.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee. I have a brief overview, and I'll try to move through it promptly, though. Don't hesitate to pose questions for me if I'm not complete or thorough enough, and I'll try to either answer those now or bring information back to you at our next session to answer your questions or distribute materials to you. The Fish Division of the Department of Fish and Wildlife is responsible for the management of all freshwater fishes and all marine fish and shellfish in the state, including in state-managed waters in the ocean along our shores. The program works with protection of habitat, with production of fish species, and with the management of their use. It's a highly diverse program, and it's a very decentralized program, with fishery biologists and technicians based on each one of the watersheds you see on the map here, plus in several coastal ports for the management of marine species and marine port and commercial fisheries. It's also quite a large program. Approximately two-thirds of the staff of the Department of Fish and Wildlife are assigned to various fish and fishery activities. The fish programs of the Department of Fish and Wildlife are divided into four principal program areas. The first of those is called natural production, and this area is responsible for the management and planning of naturally produced fish species in the state. The second is fish propagation, which is responsible for the operation of our large hatchery system. The third is marine resources, which oversees the management of marine fishes and shellfishes. And the fourth is interjurisdictional fisheries, which are responsible for management in waters which are jointly managed by other states or other governments. The budget of the Fish Division of the Department is heavily dominated by federal funds. About 55% of the total fishery budget comes from various federal programs and federal agencies. Some of this is mitigation for the construction of federal projects in Oregon, such as dams or jetties and navigation channels. Some of it is for various contract studies for the collection of information. Some of it is for restoration projects of various kinds. And the final segment of this is the so-called Wallenbro or Port Fish Restoration Program, by which the federal government gives back to us a share of the excise taxes on fishing tackle, on outboard motors, on boat fuel, and other activities by sport fishermen. Many of these programs have match requirements in state dollars, so this is a long-winded way of explaining that not only is about two-thirds of the fish budget tied up in federal programs where the federal government tells us how they can be spent, but in order to receive those monies,
a share of our state dollars are also committed to the match to those federal programs, though we would not receive the federal dollars. The two biggest issues to the fish programs of the department in the last 2 years have been continued Endangered Species Act listings by the federal government and the changes that those have brought in our management programs, and the Oregon Plan, by which the state of Oregon, various state agencies, local governments, and private individuals have worked together with the support and encouragement of the legislature to develop a plan for restoring listed fishes in Oregon by means other than simply handing our management responsibilities over to the federal government. Because of the fact that the Department of Fish and Wildlife and the Fish Division primarily make decisions and approach controversial public policies by providing information and doing a scientific analysis, another part of understanding the fish programs of the department is to understand that we have very substantial information needs. We collect a great deal of information every year about the fish of Oregon and about the activities of anglers and commercial fishermen. We are the primary source of information not only for our own decisions, but decisions by other natural resource agencies, for decisions by local government, and decisions by federal agencies, which gather very little fishery information on their own. One more unique aspect of the Fish Division of the Department that I think will help you understand what we're about, and that is our joint management responsibilities with other jurisdictions. As I'm sure you probably understand better than I do, this is an era of analysis and decision-making by committee. There are many authorities that come to the table whenever it's decision time. And for us, this includes the Federal Fishery Management Council set up by the Federal Magnuson Act, which oversee fishery decisions outside of the three-mile limit on the coast of the western states, clear up to Alaska. Oregon participates in those two councils as a voting member. The Columbia River Compact between Oregon and Washington, where the two states have a written agreement and both vote on commercial fish issues in the Columbia River itself. The Pacific Salmon Commission, which is set up by a treaty between the United States and Canada, where Oregon is a direct and voting participant. And finally, tribal treaty rights issues, where federal courts have mandated that that tribal governments are treated as co-managers with us in reviews and decision-making. So all of these things shape and partially control our actions and our decisions. I want to say a bit about the four specific program areas of the Fish Division that I mentioned to you. Fish propagation, first of all, our hatchery programs. The state of Oregon operates 34 fish hatcheries distributed throughout the state and 15 remote or satellite sites beyond those hatcheries that either collect returning adult fish as an egg source for those hatcheries or rear and acclimate juvenile fish before they are released into individual river systems of the state. We rear and release about 75 million salmon, steelhead, and trout annually, and because some of these fish are reared in our hatcheries for over 1 year before they are released, we have over 100 million fish in our hatcheries at any given moment.
Could I, on your, yes, thank you, on your hatcheries, if I'm remembering correctly, there's a couple of those hatcheries you're closing down. There's, is that correct? And is that number reflected here?
Representative Jensen, the way our budget is structured, Fall Creek Hatchery on the Alcee River system on the coast is not within our base budget proposal, and the trout program at Willamette Hatchery near Oak Ridge and state-funded trout and salmon programs at the federally funded Coal River Hatchery on the Rogue are not within our base budget. All three of those areas are included in ad packages that are tied to our fee bill.
Can I ask, excuse me,
Can I ask one other question while we're stopped here? And that is, when we go back to your funds, how much of the federal fund match is the general fund? Do we have that information?
We use very little general fund as match for federal activities. It'll be a small number. I don't have that for you today, Representative Jensen, but I'll come up with that number for you. But our match primarily comes from wildlife fund dollars from license revenues.
I'd like that. If you have a question, then Representative.
So you just said then that we're looking at the possibility of closing the Willamette Hatchery and Oak Ridge, which is in Tony's and my district. But which package is it that would be the re-inclusion of it?
It is tied to our fee bill. I might help you here, Gilbert, but I believe that's package 200 that is included.
So I might clarify while we're checking the actual package number, Representative King, that this is the trout production at Oak Ridge, not the salmon production at Oak Ridge that we're talking about. The large facility at Oak Ridge produces spring chinook for the upper Willamette system. That wouldn't be affected by this proposal.
Mr. Chair, what would be the effect on staffing? I thought I saw like one position.
It would affect one full-time and one less than full-time position at this site.
Right.
There are seven positions in total affected by these changes in the propagation program if they were not funded in the coming biennium.
This is on page 155 and 156 of your binder, a tabbed binder, and as I mentioned, package 200.
Thank you.
In addition, in this fish propagation area of our budget, there are a number of technical activities that are associated with the operation of fish hatcheries. We have a very large program for tagging of our hatchery fish. We very carefully monitor the health of our fish to detect fish diseases and to treat fish when that appears. We have a large fleet of trucks for transporting and stocking fish. We have significant engineering and other technical support for the operation of our facilities. I think it's fair to say at this point that our hatchery system is a program in transition. It's receiving new missions today and new standards for its operation related to the operation of selective fisheries that allow access and use of hatchery fish but protect wild returning fishes, and also missions related to supplementation and rebuilding the numbers of wild populations that have declined in recent years. We're applying new technologies in how we do that and new approaches to how we utilize hatchery fish, in particular the use of 100% marks on most of our hatchery fish. At this time, all of our steelhead, all of our coho salmon, starting with this year, all of our spring chinook salmon are all marked with an adipose fin clip, a clip of the small fleshy fin near the tail of the fish, so that these can be recognized as hatchery fish. And we can conduct fisheries where the fishermen can keep these hatchery fish and release the wild fish so that we have a very high catch rate on our hatchery fish and a much lower catch rate on the wild fish so that we can best use these hatchery fish and give our fishermen fishing opportunities even in areas where protection of the wild returns is a very important issue for us and for Endangered Species Act issues. In our propagation programs, we work closely in partnership with local governments and volunteer groups. The STEP program, the Salmon Trout Enhancement Program, has many local facilities operated or assisted by volunteer groups in many parts of the state.
And in the Astoria area, we also have a partnership with the Clackamas Development Corporation and local fishermen for net pen rearing and release into Young's Bay. We have a similar partnership with the Port of Newport at the rearing pond site at South Beach, there, just upstream of the Newport Bridge. In our propagation budget, we mentioned already briefly that there are proposals for add-backs of some fish production, in particular of trout enhancement. Our plans for most effective use of fall free catchery, if they're funded, is to increase catchable trout production to provide fishing opportunities for anglers to make up for some of the losses due to closures in some areas for endangered species protection. Also, with Senate Bill 834, which would direct us to purchase trout from private facilities for stocking in the waters of the state, moves ahead. Monies in this package could be used in that area for outside purchases. So these are the packages that relate to this act here then.
Yes, Representative Jim. If we're talking about the trout and trout fish hatcheries, have we explored or do we explore the possible, do we have the capability of raising these fish to a larger size than the fingerlings basically, or the little fellows were basically raising? And I'm referring specifically to Missouri. I was down there on vacation a few years ago, and they're raising, you know, 4 and 5 pound fish that they're releasing, which make a much bigger impact on fishermen than the smaller ones.
Representative Jensen, for a number of years we have rotated the brood stock at our trout hatcheries so that we outplant those brood adults, which of course are very large attractive fish. But in recent years we have also started programs of rearing something we call super legals or super catchables, rather than fish that are at about 3 to the pound, which is our standard catchable fish. We're rearing in some programs fish of 1 pound, and in some programs a small number of fish at 2 to 3 to the pound, which we plant in some areas and well publicize for that purpose. And we've actually gotten, of course, very good angler response and interest. Also, this year we have been working with Desert Springs, a private operation, trout operation in the Summer Lake area, and have a cooperative program going between ourselves and Oregon State Parks and this private facility, where they are donating some super legal trout to us for stocking at two state parks to assess the public response and interest there and see if we should move ahead into additional super legal programs in partnership with the state park system.
Thank you.
There are no other questions for me in this area. Let me go into some brief comments on the natural production program and the of the fish division. This is the area that includes most of our field data collection and management activities in these 10 watershed areas. Most of our field staff appears in this proportion of our budget, which is about 40% of the division total. This is also the portion of our program that is responsible for gathering information on endangered species, on developing Oregon Plan measures, on the development of fish screening and fish passage facilities and their maintenance. The SHEP program, as I mentioned earlier, is administered through this area of our program and budget. The Fishery Restoration and Enhancement Program, which is overseen by an outside citizen board appointed by our commission, is administered out of this program. This program develops our sport fishing regulations, oversees watershed plans, and non-game fishes. They also are involved in the management of introduced fish species, which are naturally produced in the state, including bass, crappie, bluegill, and other non-native species. They also develop statewide management goals for our programs. They are intensively involved in technical services to landowners, in helping landowners develop proposals and projects for the protection and restoration of fish habitat. They work closely with local watershed councils to advise them and to help them develop and screen watershed proposals as well. It's this area of our program that develops information on the genetics of fishes and develops standards for wild fish management in the state. This group of biologists are working closely with the Willamette Restoration Initiative at this time and with restoration proposals for the lower Columbia River as well. There are several packages in our budget tied to our natural production program, including increased seasonal time for information collection as a means of implementing this watershed approach. Also, activities to increase efforts to recover depleted native trout stocks, in particular red band trout in the eastern portion of the state, and bull trout, which occur in high elevation cold waters in both the eastern and western portion of the state. Part of our packages in this area tied to a fee increase in package 200 include the chemical treatment and rehabilitation of the fishery in Diamond Lake and the upper Umpqua system, and the creation of a number of new fishing ponds near urban areas, which will provide new opportunities in particular for urban residents and for youth fishers as well. There's also a package within 200 that will increase warm water management activities, in particular in the far eastern portion of the state in the Ontario area, and concentrating on Brownlee Reservoir and other very productive warm water reservoirs. Packages in this area also include our continued Oregon Plan activities, which would continue existing Oregon Plan programs of the department, including the steelhead activities that were added to our budget by the Emergency Board following the last session, increased work on the effect of predation on native species, including bird predation and introduced fishes predation and predation by marine mammals. Also, additional data collection in estuaries and near shore areas of impacts of survival on juvenile and adult Oregon plan salmon and steelhead fishes. So these are the primary package areas that affect this piece of our budget. Are there questions for me here, Representative Jensen?
No, I don't have any questions. Maybe some of the members of the committee, but I think you're probably at a convenient break spot, are you?
That's right, Representative Jensen. I'm now down to the marine and interjurisdictional programs, which I could easily come back to as a separate item on Monday.
Yeah, we're looking at a 10 o'clock session, and in order to allow people to get to session-wide, unless there's some questions right now, we would adjourn for the...
Thank you.
We're adjourned.